Welcome everybody to our webinar. And if I can just start by introducing who's in the room with me. We have Tyra, who is one of our employment gurus, who's going to give us quite a bit of help around some, I would say, very pertinent subjects. Dealing with public inquiries and requests for information from traffic commissioners. We have, we'll be very familiar with, and who are going to help discuss various regulatory topics that we're going to cover this morning. So we'll just have a very quick look. Oh yes, and we have Julia, the voice. In the background here, but Julia chose not to use her voice today and asked me to do the introductions. No idea.
I'm back. Thank you for that, Jonathan. We do seem to have some sound issues, actually. We're a little bit intermittent.
The images are a bit grainy as well.
Can you just let us know, please, if you can hear us now?
Yeah, if there is a problem with the sound, do let us know. Everybody is plugged in. I'm assuming nobody's on Wi-Fi. You're not on Wi-Fi.
No, I'm not.
No. There shouldn't be a problem. Most of the screens are quite clear for me, actually. I don't know about you. Yours are grainy, are they? Oh, well, hopefully this will run smoothly. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, first of all, we're going to look at one of the issues that comes up, you know, more or less every public inquiry, which is minor or major infringements and disciplinary protocols and how you're evidencing that and what that needs to look like. And then we're going to look at a topic which I've been talking to quite a number of operators about now for the last 6 months or so, and that's drug and alcohol testing policies and what's expected, what good practice looks like compared with what in fact I'm finding. And we'll talk about that at some length. Now, the traffic commissioners have decided to issue some guidance on the role of transport consultants and the selection of transport consultants for the purposes of assisting an operator, for example, with operator's license applications. On the face of it, I know that there's quite a number of consultants listen to this, so I do strongly recommend you have a look at that guidance. I think it's very helpful, actually, and I think in many ways it will show the good from the bad. It must be that the traffic commissioners themselves experience quite a ranging quality of consultants that appear before them and understanding of the protocols, for example, at a public inquiry. And so they've obviously decided to put out some guidance. So we're going to talk through that guidance and hopefully you'll find that helpful. But if you are a consultant listening, and I know quite a number do, then please feel free to ask for the link to the guidance. I'll try and get Chloe to send a link out after the training.
Okay, just pause, Jonathan. I think
okay, sorry about that. We are trying to take some steps to put this right. It might be the case that we're better only having one speaker on at a time. So as I introduce you in to talk about something, maybe the less people on the screen, the less impact it's going to have on others. It'll narrow down the bandwidth. And so we're then going to talk about Connor Construction, and that's a decision that took place, and some obiter. That means effectively non-binding comments made by the judge in the upper tribunal with regard to that case that the traffic commissioners are taking now as being the rule going forwards. But the impact on the passenger as well as the goods sector could be quite significant. So I think you need to be aware of that. We're going to talk through that. And finally, we're going to look at load security and the issues around load security that are raising their head again at the moment. And Laura's got some quite interesting stats that she picked up this week on load security. So without further ado,
and we look good, we're good on the sound now, it's better without the number of screens.
Okay, so that's unfortunate, but I think it looks like we're going to have to be one at a time, guys. So first of all, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. Minor infringements. Now, those of us who regularly look at operator systems, either before a public inquiry or when carrying out some form of compliance review or audit, will regularly ask to see infringement reports for driver's hours offences. And what we will tend to be presented with are reams and reams of reports that just have a signature on the bottom and very little other information other than a bland description by the computer software as to what that predicted was wrong. And that description can often be incorrect. For example, it might say that somebody's breached the 4.5 hour brake rule, whereas in fact there's a mode switch error. But that's not identified on it. The driver seems to have signed the document. What's that really telling you? So at this point, I'm just going to ask Tyra just to come on screen, hopefully. Hi, Tyra. Effectively here, we've got a scenario where these infringements might be very minor, and I'm talking sub 5 minutes infringement, maybe on a 4.5 hour break or on a daily drive or a daily rest even, where they've either finished the rest just 5 minutes too early or they've not stopped 2 or 3 minutes early enough. How do you think an operator should be trying to document this from an employment perspective?
Okay. Thanks, Jonathan. Yeah, from an employment perspective, I think the starting point, as you said, there isn't enough information that's provided, is an investigation. So it would be prudent for the employer to have their own investigation. So the starting point would be to speak to the employee involved. Let's find out exactly what's happened and find out exactly what they, if there is an explanation. And once you've got that explanation from the employee, you can then move forward. Once you've discussed it with them, was it a genuine mistake? Was it an error? Are they new? Is it something that they're not, you know, that they're not familiar with? If they are a newly trained driver, for example, so and make sure that we keep minutes as well of anything we do. Keep a record. I've often had judges say to respondents, the most important thing in business is pen and paper. Write down whatever you do, and the same principle would apply to, you know, if anybody was in a public inquiry. So write down what you do. So speak to the employee. Make a note, and then you can decide what action is appropriate. So it may be that once you've got the information from the employee, you think, well, actually, I think I accept the explanation. We can deal with this informally, and I don't need to take it any further. There could be a training need that's identified as from the discussion. And if that's the case, it isn't something that you can internally arrange some training. It may be other drivers you feel may benefit from that as well, especially if you see the same issue arise with other drivers as well. So we can have a look at that. But it's important to make notes because the issue may arise again. And if it does arise again, then we need to think, what do we need to do about it? So initially, you may be able to have perhaps an informal warning or just document on their record. But if we need to go further, it's important we can show from an employment tribunal and for the traffic commissioner that we have spoken to the employee, we've identified and dealt with it appropriately. So I think it's important. Starting point, let's speak to the employee, find out what's happened, keep a note, and then from there decide what we can do in the future.
Yeah, and I think from that discussion, you will very quickly assess whether the employee actually understands what they've done wrong, but has an explanation for it, or maybe they've just made a mistake, or whether actually the employee doesn't understand what they've done wrong, and therefore they need obvious, more detailed training and reminding. Also, with regard to that, just from a perspective of simplicity, you can use the infringement report to record that information, that conversation. And I strongly recommend you do that. A lot of the modern software allows you now to add in effectively the driver's comments and your comments. And so you've got that record. Now then, Tara, though, that's fair enough. But what if month after month, the same driver or drivers are continuing to commit very similar style offences?
I think if it continues, and that's why I say keep a record, if they've had the training, if initially it was decided it was a training need, perhaps, if it keeps happening, then the employer does need to take more serious action. And I think at that point, possibly escalate it to a disciplinary. If we're getting the repeat issues, again, they've had the training and there's no other explanation, then it has to be looking at a disciplinary process. And again, we can advise you through that. But again, we need to make sure that we keep notes. So at that point, if we've identified everything and the minor infringements keep happening, then we're looking at potentially going through the disciplinary process of a written warning, final written and dismissal. So ultimately, if these errors keep occurring, these mistakes, it could ultimately still result in a dismissal, which is why it's important to that we keep notes and we can document everything that we've done from a tribunal perspective as well, to show that as a reasonable employer, you know, this is we follow the due correct process and advise the employer every opportunity, but because there's no improvement. So it's important to make sure we write everything down right at the outset, so we can show we've now had to go to disciplinary because we've just not had any improvement.
Okay, now Scott's actually got a very recent example of a case he dealt with regard to this issue. And perhaps it's worth talking through.
Yeah, so I recently dealt with an operator, and they had a new transport manager who came into a business. And at the point he joined the business, I think they were running at around about a 28% infringement rate. So 28 infringements for every 100 shifts, you know, far too high. A lot of minor, silly infringements that were being committed. And within 6 months, he managed to reduce that down to a 1.5% infringement rate. Without actually issuing one single disciplinary. And I asked him how he managed that. And he basically said, all I did was properly explain the infringements to the drivers, educated them fully on what was happening and why it was happening. But I actually looked further than just the drivers. I looked at our planning team, our logistics team, and see what was happening in that process, which may cause or allow a driver to infringe. And I was encouraging the logistics team to actually look at that process and say, actually, can we plan the work better so that we know at 6 hours work, there's a break almost scheduled within the planning team, so that they know there's a drop and there's an availability for a location for a break. So we looked at it as a whole process rather than just looking at it as a driver issue. And he said, I actually made some significant gains in just educating the planning team as to what was needed and building that in into the working day, and they achieved massive results. And the knock-on effect of that was when they came to public inquiry and some of the drivers had to attend for driver conduct hearings, some of them actually said, you know, I've been driving 25 years, I've never had that sort of level of arm around my shoulder, this is what's happened, this is what, you know, we want to do about it, and this is how I think you should plan your day. And it made a significant difference at the end at the public inquiry, you know, to the extent that the Traffic Commission took no action against the operator. And it's all down to that. So it's not all about beating the driver with a stick. The other thing I would add is I think drivers, everybody sort of wants to know what the expectation is. So if you're having a conversation with a driver of a particular infringement, what's your expectation for improvement in the future? You know, are you saying over the next 3 months, I expect to see a significant reduction in these silly errors? Or are you saying, I don't want to see any silly errors? You know, is that realistic given the work type you do? So, you know, think about it in that way. Give them a clear expectation of what you wish for the drivers to achieve. I think that's some good tips.
Okay, thanks for that, Scott. Now moving on to the next slide. And this is slightly different. And this is where the infringements are more serious. Now, what's important here is I'm not talking about false record infringements. I'm talking about maybe half an hour over on your daily driving, half an hour short on your daily rest, an hour short on your weekly rest, or maybe just 15 minutes short on your 4.5 hours. You know, a period of time that isn't just an accident or a slip up, a period of time that they should know what they should have done, and they've clearly, if you like, pushed it too far. And these sorts of items should be falling into your serious misconduct bracket. Now, when we're looking at something like this and a topic like this, I think it's helpful to understand the difference between serious misconduct and gross misconduct. And Tara, if you could just give a little bit of help on that question first.
Thank you, Jonathan. Yeah, I think this is what causes people a little bit of trouble. I think we can easily identify gross misconduct. We look at theft, we look at assaults. You can identify it straight away, acts of dishonesty, people that have been fraudulent on timesheets and things like that. So we can identify those quite easily as gross misconduct. So serious misconduct would be anything short of that. Now, of course, in our industry, in this industry, there are things that we would deem as serious misconduct that perhaps perhaps other industries wouldn't. So I think it's a good idea to make sure that your disciplinary procedures are up to date as well. I've had a client come to me recently who had an audit, and they were criticised that the disciplinary procedures didn't include particular instances, you know, for the driving industry, for the gross and serious misconduct. And I think an employee should know from the outside what is expected of them. And they should know this is going to be serious conduct and this is gross misconduct. Serious misconduct could result in termination of employment as well, but it has to be investigated as well. It has to be investigated as with any, as we even started off with the informal. So I would still be looking at starting an investigation, but it's likely with a serious misconduct, you are going to issue a warning. So it is much more serious than the informal issues and the minor infringements that you discussed before, Jonathan. So a serious misconduct, it will definitely be a disciplinary and a sanction, albeit it may fall short of a dismissal. It might be a final written warning. And there may be various circumstances we consider, experience of a driver, length of service, things like that. All things that tribunal would consider as well. In the circumstances, would it be fair? So that's really the main things that we'd be looking at.
Okay. And so when we're looking at serious misconduct, I mean, you said there a moment ago that you may even justify a dismissal for serious misconduct. This is putting you on the spot a little bit, but what sort of scenario would that look like?
I think one of the things that does cause an issue actually is failure to carry out a first use check. I have clients who do class that as, in their gross misconduct, it's very clearly set out as gross misconduct. However, there may be circumstances where somebody doesn't treat it as that. Now, for example, somebody may be able to explain why they haven't carried out a first use check. They may have a reasonable explanation. There may be some mitigation which would perhaps take the dismissal element away and bring it down to a final written warning. So it depends on the circumstances. And again, the tribunals consider those things as well. Usually somebody's length of service and experience are those factors that could bring something down from dismissal to perhaps a final written warning.
The most important thing when you're producing evidence, for example, to the Traffic Commission of disciplinary action of matters that are going to be overtly serious misconduct. And so, for example, the Traffic Commissioner might ask for the infringement records for the last 3 months. And in those records, it might demonstrate several infringements that are obvious serious misconduct. The next question the Traffic Commission is going to ask of the operator is, well, what evidence have you got of disciplinary protocol? What sort of evidence should you be able to produce? Because this is a more formal process.
Yeah, more formal process. So we start off with an investigation, appoint an appropriate person. And as I said earlier on, keep notes of your investigation. Keep minutes of that meeting so you can establish that you have spoken to the individual, you've got their explanation. Now, the employee may offer in their explanation, they may say, well, actually, such and such a document, have a look at CCTV, you know, have a look at my actual timesheet, not just the tachograph, you know, let's have a look at the traffic for that day. You know, I can explain why this isn't recorded right. This is why the infringement is. And then we can go and look at all those other documents as well. So we've got the minutes, and then it may be appropriate to keep records of timesheets, you know, routes of traffic and things like that. So anything as part of that investigation should be kept, so we can show that we've investigated that and then be able to justify why we've taken the action. If we've decided not to take any action, especially with a serious misconduct, we need to be able to justify that. And the only way we can do that is if we keep minutes and notes of what we've done.
Yeah. Okay. And I think that's really what the traffic commissioners are looking for. They're looking for a proper report, a proper investigation and evidence to support your conclusions.
If I could just add on that, one of the frustrations I quite often have, I see a disciplinary letter for TACO infringements and it's very vague. So it might say, you've received a written warning for your recent tachograph infringements. And I sort of then have to ask, well, which ones have you considered? Is it, you know, July? Is it August? You know, which ones are you actually considering? Which ones are we dealing with in this instance? So try and be as specific as you can, try and detail properly what you've actually taken into account, because that helps actually in the end when a year down the line, I'm asking you the question of actually what happened in this particular instance.
Yeah, because the employee needs to know exactly what the case is against them, so they can provide the proper explanation.
Yeah, absolutely.
There has been quite a lot of discussion, if you don't mind, if I can just weave these in.
So, the voice is back.
I'm back. So somebody's saying, Tara, that really in this climate, you know, dismissal for failure to carry out a first use check is unrealistic unless there's a serious consequences of, say, like wheel loss. Yeah. So,
I mean, there's two different issues. Firstly, is have they carried out the first use check at all? That's the first element. And then we get to the element of if they have they done it properly and have they missed things? So I appreciate, I think that in the current climate, people don't always necessarily want to terminate. They want to retain good staff, especially if you think, well, actually, I accept this may be a genuine mistake. This isn't like this driver. They've been employed for 20, 30 years, whatever it may be. I accept that, you know, there may have been personal circumstances, things like that. So again, this is what it comes down to. There may be some mitigating circumstances, but overall, we do need to be careful because we don't want to set a precedent. So not everybody would treat a failure to do a first use check as a gross misconduct. I think it's something that does cause a little bit of a controversy. Not many people do, but there are equally clients who have it as a gross misconduct. But if we can look at and it comes back to the investigation, let's investigate. And if there are reasons why we're not going to dismiss, then as long as we document those, we can show that, again, we've done everything that we possibly can. And that's why we've come to the conclusion and we've backed it up with evidence.
I think with regard to first use inspections and gross misconduct, I think the issue is that a lot of people mistake the difference between failure to do a first use inspection and then a vehicle goes out on the road where somebody's failed to do a first use inspection and a major fault is found on the vehicle. Remember, the error is the same. The activity, the wrongdoing, is the failure to carry out the first use inspection. The fact that had they carried it out, they might have found something is always the case. I mean, 9 out of 10 times, hopefully, if you're a good operator, there's nothing wrong with that vehicle. So failure to carry out the first use inspection actually carries only a proportionately low risk. However, I don't personally think there's any difference between failure to carry out a first use inspection where there's nothing wrong with the vehicle and failure to carry out a first use inspection where subsequently there's found to be something wrong with the vehicle. So I think you've got to be careful. I always ask the question when that exact point is made of the operator, well, hang on a minute. If you'd found a driver who'd not done a first use inspection, that vehicle had gone out, a wheel had come off, which was obviously used, and had he done the first use inspection, he'd have seen it and killed someone, you would almost certainly sack them, because every operator I've ever dealt with in that scenario has, and I've dealt with a few, sadly, over the years. What's the difference? His failure is no different from the other driver who's just lucky that there wasn't a fundamental problem with his vehicle, because they both failed on the same question. So I think you've got to be very careful. Now, yes, is it unrealistic to dismiss drivers for failing to carry out first use inspections? Well, traffic commissioners have begun to recognise that the climate of driver shortage has meant operators are keeping drivers who they wouldn't normally keep. Are there, though, potentially other sanctions that can be taken against a driver that maybe puts them on a significant period of probation if you like, that means that, okay, we're going to keep you, but this is gross misconduct. We're going to lessen the penalty and keep you because of all sorts of business reasons, as well as perhaps your own personal circumstances. However, you're on an extended probation. Yeah.
Final written warning, which would stay on the record for 12 months. So if we're not going to dismiss, then certainly for serious misconduct and issues like that, I think it has to be, well, on the circumstances, at least a final written warning, so there is something on the record.
And it's, sorry, just can I jut in here that someone has said, if there was personal circumstances involved, you know, would the TC want the specific details, or would they just willingly accept the decision that you've made?
So what I would say, so let's say you lessen the sanction. So I would always say starts at gross misconduct. If you lessen the sanction, it's fine. For me, then it goes into mitigation of risk procedures. So you'd probably want closer monitoring of that particular driver and evidence that closer monitoring. The traffic commission would accept that. You know, they often say that we'd rather you educate the driver than dismiss and they become somebody else's problem. You know, you know you're aware of the issue. You're then closely monitoring the issue and managing that risk going forward. And actually, that's a very sensible thing to do. They will take into account personal circumstances of a driver. You know, I'm dealing with a case next week with false records where the operators determined that they'll keep the driver on, even though they've committed false records, because of the personal circumstances. And, you know, actually that driver has shown the turnaround. His record is absolutely clear over the last 8 months. So it actually is a bit of a success story rather than just dismissing 8 months ago and him or her just going off and being a problem for somebody else. So, you know, I think as long as you document it, you can justify it. Yeah. And there's proper mitigation of risk principles behind it in terms of your management. For me, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, even the Health and Safety Executive on some quite serious breaches by individuals are encouraging firms to keep people on and train them rather than dismiss them, which is quite interesting, or at least they were a couple of years ago. I don't know if they still are. I think the first use inspection question is always a fascinating question. But Laura had some interesting statistics on first use inspections with regard to what's actually found on roadside prohibitions.
Yeah, I think, well, you're saying that my statistics, I've stolen them from DVSA really, but the number one defect that's identified at the roadside is always consistently condition of tyres, which is a driver type defect. They should be spotting that. And then 7 of the top 10 defect items, the types of defect found at the roadside, are again things that are covered on the driver's walk around check. So it just shows really the importance of your drivers conducting a walk around check in the first place and conducting one thoroughly and comprehensively enough that they're going to be spotting these issues and therefore preventing that vehicle being on the road in a condition where it's going to attract a prohibition or even an S-marked prohibition, which is pretty much your golden ticket to public inquiry if you get an S-marked prohibition. So the steps you can take to reduce that risk of that vehicle being out in that condition are really, really key. And a robust driver walk around process supported and underpinned by your disciplinary regime is absolutely critical.
I think I've got our next training title. Instead of Willy Wonka's golden ticket, it's Wonky Wheels golden ticket.
But talking of training, Jonathan, there is no official guidance out there to deal with tachographs and how to manage those tachograph systems. You look on the DVSA guidance notes, there is absolutely nothing.
No.
Effective sort of tachograph analysis and management of that is very complicated, and there is a training course coming up, I think, Julia, soon, where we go through what we believe to be an effective system to manage that risk and how we suggest you deal with those sort of minor infringements and how you deal with those more major infringements and what sort of elements go into that. So for those who are interested, please have a look at that training.
Our six-point plan, which is actually, we've made that up, but it's very good, I think. And if you follow it, you're likely to be in a very strong position when it comes to those types of issues. Okay, moving on to the next topic. And if we can all pop on and off the screen as we do, just to keep the speed of the internet working properly. Now, one of the big questions that I've come across now in the last 6 months, about half a dozen times, I mean, over the years, we all come across this issue, but it's suddenly becoming a much hotter issue. And this is drug and alcohol testing and the policies that we need to have in place for drug and alcohol testing. Now, one of the issues with drug and alcohol testing that I, well, there's two issues that I come across. I come across an issue where the employer is seriously concerned that if they carry out such a policy, random testing of drivers, as opposed to just testing on suspicion, that they will suddenly find themselves short of drivers on a Monday morning. Now, everybody listening, and I'm sure everybody in the industry would say, well, that's not really a good enough reason, but it is a genuine reason that I have been given by an operator as to why he doesn't carry out those types of testing. And secondly, the issue is operators or transport managers certainly who really want to have drug and alcohol testing on a very frequent basis and randomly are having a tremendous amount of trouble persuading the union that this is an appropriate activity, and the unions push back very hard on it. And so, first of all, before I get into our perspectives, and we listen to Scott and Laura on their perspectives on this, I'm just going to ask Tara, from the perspective of a policy, a workplace policy, is there anything wrong with having both targeted, where you may have suspicion, and also random, where there is no suspicion, but random, where you make sure you cover all your driver's workforce at least once in a defined period, say 6 months or a year? Is there anything wrong with that?
I don't think so. And I think given the safety critical role, particularly that drivers do, I think we need to have that in place. Like you, Jonathan, I've seen an increase of clients coming to me about concerns about drivers, and some of those clients don't have any policy in place. And of course, if you don't have a policy in place, you can of course ask the employee if you believe or have a suspicion. But of course, if they say no, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it, because there's nothing that we can rely on. If you're then concerned about putting that driver out there, then obviously it comes with a risk. So I think given the role that people do, I think you need to protect your position and have that in place. And it supports tribunals as well, because it's the starting point. If we dismiss somebody, the tribunal will ask for what policy and what procedure have you got in place. And I know that it's some people's concern is, well, you've got drivers, but then you might have warehouse staff and things like that. I mean, it's fine to treat people and have different categories, as long as your policy sets out which category of employees will be treated with, you know, whatever policy it is you decide, that's fine. But it's the fact that the effects of the alcohol can affect, or drugs can affect, in different ways. And not just the driver, you've got folk with truck drivers perhaps in warehouse, you've got people, you know, climbing ladders maybe, working with electrical equipment. And we've got to, let's not forget, the basic principle is we've got a duty of care to employees, to all employees as well. And especially when we're sending out our drivers, there's a duty there to the public as well. So we need to ensure that our drivers are safe when they're out on the road, because the repercussions would just be absolutely huge. And I think nobody wants to think about what could happen if we know there was something that we could do about it. So have a policy in place. Yes, we can make it specific to different people and different categories of staff.
Now, just looking at drug and alcohol policies, I'm just going to give you an example of a case I dealt with last year. The operator had a driver on the road pulled over by the DVSA, and the DVSA officer opened the door to the driver's cab, and it absolutely was full of marijuana smoke. Furthermore, the driver had in his hand a cigarette with marijuana in it that he was rolling. She immediately called the police over. He was arrested, taken away. She called the operator. The operator came, and after their next driver was tested, he was fine, drove the vehicle away. What was really remarkable about that case is that driver was obviously released later that day. The following day, that driver's back in that vehicle driving. Now, from the Traffic Commissioner's perspective, the Traffic Commission in that particular case was absolutely dumbfounded that the operator was enabling and allowing that driver to return to work. They assumed that straight away he'd be suspended, and then a dismissal would very shortly follow. What was quite appreciative when dealing with that case is that the operator themselves just hadn't considered the issue of putting that driver back behind the wheel, on the basis that he said, well, the police wouldn't release the driver until he tested negative. And we know the driver the following day hadn't taken drugs because we tested him. So there's two sides to this. One, if you catch a driver either taking drugs whilst driving or alcohol whilst driving over the limit, then quite frankly, that's gross misconduct. And that should result in an investigation. I don't think it has to be too lengthy, but an investigation followed by a dismissal. Now, there are certain drugs that do actually are legally taken that do actually give a positive drug test. So when you're asking for medical questionnaires from your drivers, maybe annually at least, which you should do, and they should also update you if they are given prescribed drugs that might cause an issue on a drug test, then it's extremely important that you're aware of that, because that would be a defence, not only to being dismissed, but also to any prosecution if they failed a drug test at the roadside that the police conducted on them. So in those scenarios, Tara, is there any good advice we can give to an operator just to make sure that they're not accidentally catching people who are on legitimate, legally prescribed drugs as opposed to illegally and illicit obtained drugs?
I think it depends on the various testing kits these days, and sometimes you do have to send them back to the lab, I think, with a lot of tests. So I think that if there is a positive, I think the best way to secure is still potentially having to look at suspension until we can corroborate, especially we haven't got the proof. And I think it's only when a test is done that a driver will say, oh, sorry, I forgot to tell you I'm on such and such a medication. So we can, and that all comes as part of the investigation. So the first part is we do the test, there's a positive, driver at that point may say, oh no, it's because of X, Y, and Z. And at that point, that's when we could have to send the tests off for further for clarification or part of your investigation. So that is we need to consider that before we go any further. But the suspension still in the meantime needs to happen, because we don't know if it's going to come back positive or negative, of course.
No, and I think if you're caught with, I think Scott told me it's called a joint in your hand, then actually you are pretty much hung, drawn and quartered, I would say. Obviously the evidence that you've got that they've actually taken drugs is a really important case. I think one of you two had a case recently, didn't you, with a driver?
Oh, I had a brilliant one where the operator got told by the police that the football coach was going to get pulled over and everybody was going to get tested, and they were going to make sure there was nobody drinking and X, Y, Z on the coach. So the operator told the organiser of the said football coach and told the driver, police pulled them over, as they got told they would do. Pretty much everything else was on fine with the coach. They did find a 12-year-old boy with £2,000 worth of cash on him and no responsible adults, which was dealt with. And the police were about to let the coach on the way and said, oh, we haven't tested the driver. And of course, they tested the driver and he tested positive for cocaine. The operator, every officer, what more can I realistically do?
Quite frankly, if you're not, if you're employing a large number of drivers, then and don't have a drug and alcohol testing policy, then I think in the current climate, it's highly likely on a Monday morning, at least one driver is over the drug drive limit, full stop. And you are sort of expected to be on notice of that as an operator and expected to act on it. And if you've had a driver pulled in the last, let's say, 5 years, and that driver has tested positive for either alcohol or drugs, then you should have responded to that by establishing a protocol, as in a drug testing and alcohol policy. And I don't think on suspicion is enough. I think you need random testing. And I think you need to make sure you're covering your workforce, certainly within a year, maybe more frequently, depending on the nature of the work and from where you're obtaining your workers. There's certain areas of the country where drugs are way more prevalent than others.
Lots of discussion on this, actually. So I know we've got a lot to cover, but Tara, somebody's saying that we are introducing a drug testing policy and one employee is refusing to sign receipt and acceptance. What do you do if he refuses to complete a test?
You can introduce a policy. There's no issue around that. So you can introduce a policy. Have they consulted and have they spoke with him about the policy? And I wonder whether he's offered any explanation as to why he's not prepared to. But again, as part of the policy, we should be including those employees that don't, once we've introduced a policy, that don't give consent and the consequences of if they refuse to give consent or take part in a test. Because of course, that in itself could also be classed as gross misconduct. So let's include that in the policy. So the policy itself is very important. So once we've introduced that policy, we don't need the employee's consent to introduce the policy, but make sure it's covered and it's noted and it's explained to them that if they do refuse and if they are selected, then there are repercussions. So a well-drafted policy is really the starting point.
And we can, of course, assist with that, can't we, Tara?
Yes, we can.
There are as well, aren't there, Jonathan? There's devices you can get to actually fit to the vehicle, so the driver has to test every day, and if they blow and it results in a positive test, the vehicle's immobilised, they can't actually then drive.
Yeah. In fact, taxi drivers in Sweden, I discovered once, flying into Sweden for something, can't move if they don't blow clear every hour unless they're actually driving at the time that the hour passes. So if they switch off their car for an hour, they have to blow another test to demonstrate they're not over the limit, and that's quite common. And I've seen that in quite a few trucks as well. And that may be the way that it's actually going in any event. But the other second element to this, I know time is moving on, but it's good that you're interested
in
this.
I've got lots of questions, Jonathan.
Yeah, the other second element to this, well, we can always move some of the later topics onto a different webinar. Is the union involved? And unions seem to push back really hard on these policies. But my view is, would you expect to see drug and alcohol taking on an oil rig? And the answer is no, because it's a highly dangerous, highly risky activity. Would you expect to see it in a nuclear power station? No. Potentially dangerous, potentially risky activity. Well, haulage and bus and coach operation is high risk, very dangerous activity. And I just don't think the union can legitimately put forward an argument that this isn't a legitimate policy. And I think you're being weak. I mean, imagine it being in the press that the union are encouraging their drivers to strike because they won't accept the adoption of a drug and alcohol policy. I mean, the public would be shocked that they don't already have one. So I think you've got to be tough on that. And if the union need help with educating on that point, I've done such educational training sessions for unions, for operators over the years, and we would be more than happy to deliver that training to either union representatives or the workforce in general. I think it's obvious that it's important.
Okay, so just two points here. Tara, can you remind the listeners how often that you'd recommend that the driver should be tested for alcohol and drugs?
It depends on whether we're looking at drivers or whether you're looking at a different category of employees. So you can, as I said, treat them differently. But it really does depend. It can be once every 2 or 3 months. It can be longer than that. It really is entirely up to the client what they think is reasonable, and it depends how many drivers have we got. Do we think we're high risk? How many times have the issues arisen before? Do we have suspicion of individuals? Taking all those things into account, and then we can make a decision and think, well, actually, we think it's reasonable. We think we are high risk because of this has happened before, and we think it's reasonable, you know, to be testing every once a month or every, you know.
Well, there are operators who test weekly on a Monday morning, every Monday morning on certain types of work, you know, so if that's relevant.
One of the listeners has said that National Express coach requires testing each time a vehicle moves.
Correct. Yeah, you know, it's very, it's, you know, I don't think anybody's going to have any sympathy with a workforce that are saying we don't want to be tested. Why don't you want to be tested is the next obvious question. Yeah.
And in terms of the testing kit, somebody also has said, you know, can an operator use devices sold online? You know, are they still accepted as valid?
Yes, they are. Yeah. I mean, there's some pretty good equipment out there now. Yeah. The drug testing, you often have to take the test and then send the sample away. So you might get an immediate response, but you don't know what the drug is. And if the, as Tara said earlier, if the employee is challenging it, then you send it away and get it analysed. And it might say it's a medical based opioid or something that the driver themselves might not actually be aware is in the medication they're taking. But if you actually read the document that comes with the medication, it will normally outline what's in the medicine. Okay, so we're going to move on to a topic now that well, it was controversial in our office as to whether we should talk about it, but I think we should. The traffic commissioners have actually published a guide to instructing transport consultants. Now, what's interesting about this is that they felt that they should do this. That's the starting point. And I think I'm going to start this. I'm very neutral on this. We use consultants. Many of you will be listening. We use consultants as part to assist us in the preparation of cases on a very regular basis. And I believe that the consultants we use are first class and do a really high quality job, or we wouldn't use them. I think my starting point is there are obviously some very good transport consultants out there who do a very good job and offer a very good service. But for the traffic commissioners to provide this type of guidance, there must be a proportion of consultants, or at least people offering their services as consultants, out there who are not meeting the standards that the traffic commissioners would like you to meet. And I think in those circumstances, they've obviously felt that they should give some guidance. Now, actually, the guidance is very good, in my opinion. What they've sought to do really is outline in this guidance the sort of common issues that they are finding with some of the consultants. I'm being really careful here, but with some of the consultants that they're using. And I'm just going to very quickly take you through them. So first of all, if the consultant is offering license application assistance services, so you're helping an operator either apply for a license or apply for changes, variations as they're known, to their license. Okay, the first mistake with this is that the consultant do not themselves seek to be able to register to access VOL, but instead are using their clients' access details. So for example, a member of maybe the transport manager for the operator's details in lodging the application for their client. Traffic commissioners find this extremely frustrating, and in fact will bar you if they discover this happening, and they check emails. So if they discover this happening, they will in fact bar the organization from being able to access VOL, which right now is a nightmare for an operator. So the starting point is seek authorization from the administrator to have your own access.
I hold the record at the moment, Jonathan, according to the traffic commissioners. I have the most amount of login details on Vol for all operators, I believe. So my name is the, or my email address is the most heavily logged in or something that I use for all operators. I hold the record.
Yeah, Scotty runs our application team, and so effectively we do this. We do manage people's applications, and in fact in doing so we do seek permission through their administration to have rights to make applications on their behalf.
The traffic commission knows it's me, basically.
Yeah, and that's the point. What they want a consultant to do is identify as themselves in the application so that they can see from whom the information is coming. I do encourage you to read the guidance, but other bits in the guidance that are really important are that the traffic commission is expecting you, the consultant, to properly pressure the operator on all the core questions: entity, transport management, number of vehicles, is the setup at the moment legal, is it not, do they have to stop doing what they're doing until they become legal, do they need an emergency interim. All those are core questions that the traffic commissioner is actually putting in the guidance to operators when selecting their consultant. They're also encouraging operators to ask their consultant for their qualifications and experience, but not just the individual that heads up the consultancy, but also any employee that might be actually doing the work. for that consultancy. What is your experience? What is your training?
And actually, Jonathan, somebody has specifically said, you know, is there a professional association for consultants?
No,
not as far as we're aware, no. And that is a problem. Because, as I say, I think the consultants, certainly we come across and we use, generally speaking, they're excellent. So they provide a really high quality service. It's clear that that isn't always the case, so far as the traffic commissioners are concerned. Now, the other core element that arises out of this that really needs some thought is representation at public inquiry. Now, traffic commissioners have to accept a solicitor or a barrister as a representative. They don't have a choice, they have to. And that's because we have governance by independent professional body governance. So we have, for example, the SRA and the Bar have the Bar Council. And we also have the Law Society. So in essence, we have to do so many things to put our ducks in a row that that we get the right to be able to represent people in hearings. That is not the case for anybody else. Anybody else who wants to represent an operator in a hearing who isn't the actual operator or a director thereof must seek the permission of the traffic commissioner in advance of the hearing. So you've got to write and ask, is it okay if I represent? Now, obviously, if a consultant regularly appears before a traffic commissioner and is accepted before that traffic commissioner, then that's okay. But if the consultant is new in that area or doesn't regularly represent operators, then you need to ask permission. And the traffic commissioner is going to ask you what your knowledge, expertise, qualification and skill is. So be aware that that's coming. The other core thing is, as lawyers, we have to do continuing professional development. As transport managers, you have to do continuing professional development. Well, what the traffic commissioner is saying is they're also going to ask you, the operator, to ask your consultant, how are they keeping themselves up to date? And they will seek evidence of that. So you could say, for example, I've followed the Backhouse Jones webinar for the last 2 years and learned a lot of information from that. And that would be part of your continuing professional development. So that's fine. But they're probably going to want to see you attend courses, refreshers, receive notifications from the DVSA and the Office of the Traffic Commissioner that they publish from time to time. So that's also in it. But the other big mistake made is whether you are representing your clients at a public inquiry as a consultant or whether you are actually just producing a report on behalf of your client that you've compiled, which means you are a witness to the hearing. The difference being a witness gives evidence on what they've observed and seen from their expert capacity, which many consultants do regularly, both in inquiries for us and inquiries for others. That is very different from being a representative. A representative produces and represents the case and asks the operator to deliver evidence and manages the dialogue with the traffic commissioner and makes submissions. That is a very different role and I think is often not understood properly, but it is explained to a degree in this guidance. And generally speaking, my advice is if you've compiled a report and you're producing that report as evidence for the hearing, you can't then also be the witness. The representative.
Some of the confusion arises that because the form that you're required to fill in and send back to the traffic commissioner's office asks if you're being represented by somebody. And sometimes operators answer that by saying yes, but putting the name of the transport consultant that's perhaps prepared a report and is helping them with that process.
Yeah.
And that often leads to further questions from the traffic commissioner. And they've certainly had some cases where consultants have turned up on the day with operators to represent them, not having sought that permission Jonathan's referred to in advance. And it's led to the hearing having to be adjourned ultimately, yeah, which obviously has an impact for the operator concerned, particularly if you're turning up for an application, you're wanting your vehicles on the road.
Just one last point I'd make, the real big difference between legally qualified solicitors, barristers and consultants and use in hearings is the concept of privilege. So conversations between us and our clients are legally privileged. The traffic commissioner is not entitled to know the contents of those or the discussion that we've had with our clients, whereas that doesn't exist with a consultant. So the traffic commissioner could ask a consultant well, what conversation did you have with the operator? What advice did you give to the operator? Which is something that you may not want coming out given the circumstances of the particular case. So you just have to be wary of that. And that is a key distinction that you have in this field.
And there are certain obligations on legal representatives. For example, we have to have honesty. So if we know that our client is misleading the hearing, we have to identify that. And either, there's certain rules, I'm not going to go into them in detail, but we have to be of integrity. I'm not saying all solicitors are of integrity, but I'm saying we are expected to be of integrity, and those that aren't should be struck off, full stop. So we are very strictly managed there, whereas obviously the consultancies don't have such a governing body and such a strict set of rules. So be very aware, are you actually being an objective provider of information, or are you actually being subjective because, for example, it's in your interests to get a 6-month contract managing that particular individual's organisation? And these are just the sort of questions that the Traffic Commissioners are now looking at, and they are raised in this guidance. So if you are listening and you're a consultant, then have a look at the guidance. I do think it's actually very helpful. And if you're an operator and you use a consultant regularly, then I would recommend you read the guidance and go to your consultant and say, can we work through this and look at what your answers are going to be, so that you can demonstrate to a traffic commissioner that you've satisfied yourself that your consultant is providing the level of service you expect. And that's very good.
I suppose the risk with that, Jonathan, is if they don't do that, now the guidance is out there, the traffic commissioners will take you to be aware of it. So yes, if you're using a consultant and they're not fulfilling what the guidance says, you as the operator will probably be criticised for that.
Yeah. Well, they blame you for everything else.
The guidance specifically says we'll hold the operator to account if the consultant's rubbish.
Yeah, because they have no control over the consultant. The consultant can do what they like, they can walk away and do it again. Whereas the operator is the person over whom the traffic commissioner has control. And so that's the only thing they can do. They can hold it against the operator. So they do, and they will. So there you go, that guidance is out there, highly worth reading. Now the next
topic, 1.5 minutes, Jonathan,
I know, I've seen.
Okay, shall I just deal with this, because it's got we talked on this webinar ages ago about Connor Construction, the effects on HGV. In very basic terms, it says that for all your vehicles that you have in possession and are able to use, so discount VOR sawn vehicles, your license authority must be sufficient. So if you've got 100 vehicles in possession, you must have 100 vehicle license in general terms in HGV. Connor Construction was for HGV. The traffic commissioners and the senior traffic commissioners are currently consulting on extending that to PSV. And PSV traditionally, school bus operators, private hire, mix, they might have a license for 10 vehicles, but actually have 20 vehicles in possession because during the week they use school buses, and then during the weekend they might use private hire vehicles. The Traffic Commission is currently consulting on this that would extend it. So if you have 20 PSVs in possession, you must have a 20 vehicle license, even though on a particular day you may only use a maximum of 5, you know, which is frankly ridiculous. It's going a bit too far. I really, really encourage you, if this affects you, to raise it with your trade association, raise it with CPT, raise it with RHA coaches, raise it with us, so that we can push back against the STC practice statutory documents on this. We think it goes far too far, and it would have a massive, massive effect for the PSV industry. So just be aware of that. The consultation is out, I think it's closed, but I know there is discussions going on between the trade associations. For the trade associations to present proper evidence, they need that feedback from you as operators. So if it affects you, please.
It's not just going too far, it's just fundamentally wrong, completely in law.
It's wrong on both counts.
It's HGV specific case law that the traffic commissioners are seeking to extend to the PSV sector. It's governed by completely different legislation. It's totally wrong, and practically and operationally it's going to affect a huge volume of PSV operators, so you need to be alive to it.
And the HGV specific case law is not case law, it's non-binding. It's comments made out of the decision by a judge on his initial thoughts on a position. So the traffic commissioners have quickly seized on it and decided to use it. And I know the trade associations have pushed very hard.
Yeah, I mean, one of our listeners is saying the CPT are on this.
Well, all of the trade associations have pushed.
Well, they have, yeah. The RHA, Logistics UK, they've all been.
But it's really important that you feed that back, because the more the trade associations can feed back to the regulator and say, look, we've been contacted by hundreds of members here saying what a knock-on effect this would be. It's really, really important.
Although, Scott, are we turkeys wishing for Christmas? The more complicated this gets, the better for us.
Well, I fell out with Tim Blackmore about this last week. So.
I think we've all had our discussions on this with the TCs. Okay, there is one very brief note that Laura's going to mention for those of you who've been able to cling on.
Training. Whilst I talk about load security briefly, the training sessions for our upcoming, the training dates for our upcoming training sessions are on your screen. Load security, we'll talk about this in much more detail on a future webinar in the coming weeks, and we are going to be delivering specific e-training on it. The headline essentially is that DVSA, the Traffic Commissioners, the HSE, it is their key area of focus, particularly HGV's curtain side is involved on the pallet network side work. There are significant issues in relation to load security at the moment, and there's various initiatives that are being carried out to try raise awareness firstly, but also come up with solutions. But in the meantime, operators are being the subject of increased targeting at the roadside, particularly those curtain siders, for load security checks. And I believe there was one project on the M1 the other week where 25 lorries were stopped, 24 of them had load security issues. So it's a massive problem that's being the subject of close scrutiny by the enforcement agencies and the regulator. So if you are particularly involved in that pallet network work, make sure you are dealing with load security appropriately through your training, your policies, your procedures and your monitoring of drivers. And work with the pallet network to try and reach some form of solutions, because the Traffic Commissioners and DVSA and HSE are going to be tackling the pallet networks as well.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to call it a day there. Thank you very much, Laura. Thank you very much, Scott. Thank you very much, Tyra. Thank you very much, Julia, the voice. And we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks' time, where we'll have another fun-packed adventure of a session. Hopefully, we will solve our limitations on the router that seem to be happening.
Always when I'm behind the controls, John.
I've noticed a certain trend here.
I think it's the staff watching Love Island on the lunch break.
I'll also apologise for Scott, who was shuffling his papers while Laura was speaking, which will have come across on the mic. It's obvious he's ready for his lunch now. But the rest of us haven't quite finished.
I was doing the newsreader thing.
Yes, I thought. So it looked like the newsreader thing as well. Okay, thank you very much. See you all soon. And thank you for listening.